This is a podcast from the AHRC ICT Methods Network at www.methodsnetwork.ac.uk.
David, in his presentation, has introduced you to some of the complexities of modeling, the different types of modeling, the huge ranges of choices and decisions that have to be made at every step of the way. Not surprisingly, this has thrown up real questions of standards and of transparency to try and indicate to people who want to look at those finished models how we made those decisions, what choices we made, why we made them, what the consequences were. And one of the attempts to address these questions is something called the London Charter. And as David said, you had to wait for Richard to talk about the London Charter. I would also say, I think you may have to wait a little bit for Richard's voice. He's still checking out of the hotel. But I hope that, as Mark Twain said about modern music, it's better than it sounds. Anyway, my title is All to Make Boards to Speak, There's a Task. One of the major challenges that the digital age, and in particular the advent of 3D modeling, thrust upon us, is the reconciliation of what we see with what we know, or what we think we know, the relationship between evidence, hard fact, and our representations of those visually. Or, as it's frequently expressed these days, how do we learn to think with things? How do we get them to talk to us? How do we communicate the meanings of visualizations which we ourselves, in some cases, have not yet fully learned how to read? Of course, the art of the theater has almost from its inception exemplified a related issue. Since of the various expressive media that the theater employs, images, movement, space, sound, time, enacted actions, language is only one of these, and indeed it's often not the most prominent or the most communicated of these expressive elements in theater. That's one of the reasons why in the work of the visualization lab that I had, first at Warwick and now more recently at King's College, the research and 3D modeling of historic theater spaces and stage settings and performance has always intrigued and challenged us. Here the medium of visualization is attempting to communicate understanding about another quintessentially visual and complex medium. And as it happens, the theater too, at a crucial point in its history, faced problems not entirely unlike those which continue to confront us and confound us today in our own medium. The relationship between images and their meanings, and the vexed question of the role and status of language and words in communicating those visually embodied meanings. In the case of our own British theatre, a crisis of sorts revolving around precisely this issue was reached early in the 17th century and was embodied in two collaborators turned fierce antagonists, the playwright Ben Jonson and the architect and scenic artist Inigo Jones. Jones was introducing, through the medium of the Stuart Mask, the first perspective stage settings in Britain. Perspective, another major challenge to the systems of visualization which we rendered onto our computer screens and which Inigo Jones wrought into his experimental new picture frame stages at Whitehall Palace to delight and amaze his regal audience, who quite literally had never seen anything like it before, while at the same time antagonizing and demoralizing Ben Jonson, vainly, in both senses of the word, championing the primacy of the word. It reached a crisis in 1611 when Jonson wrote a scathing poem from which my title is excerpted, castigating both the medium and its master, whom he called that maker of shows, mighty shows, the eloquence of mask, what need of prose, or verse, or sense, to express immortal you. And then he went on to say, oh, to make boards speak, there is a task. Painting and carpentry are the soul of the mask. By contrast, in a curiously modern-sounding formulation, Jones himself described his own revolutionary scenic creations as, quoting Jones, nothing else but pictures with light and motion. A contemporary observer of one of Jones's virtual models described the production in words that might almost encapsulate the challenge we later-day modelers trying to keep up with the Joneses, face when trying to capture virtually the fleeting, now vanished objects of our investigations. That contemporaneous observer described it as, only the envy was that it lasted not still, or now, it is past, cannot by imagination, much less by description, be recovered to a part of that spirit it had in the gliding by. And this is not the occasion to attempt an analysis of the visualization strategies at work in the construction of what were termed court hieroglyphics of the mass, nor to explore the possible further intriguing affinities between it and the phenomena of our equally unreal and equally provocative creation of meaningful virtual spaces with the advanced technologies of our time. I use it instead merely as an example of the type of materials that might be used or must be used in the creation of such models, in a sense building on what David Arnold has been speaking to us about, and also what Vince said in his paper, quoting Vince, our reality is usually a degraded image of an original that has eroded or rotted away. We interpret residual or even proxy evidence to produce a new reality. Here's an example of one of those faded, rotting away images. It's from the Devonshire collection. Whoa, I don't want this to do a slideshow like that. Somebody help me. This is Jones's design for not a mass, but a production called Florimine from 1635, which was staged at Whitehall Palace, the Tudor Hall at Whitehall Palace, which actually no longer exists. Of course, the stage settings don't exist either. So in trying to recreate this, which my team did some years ago, we had to fall back on this kind of physical inadequate evidence, and also look at what accounts written that might be verbally recorded at the time, written down in diaries, about what the production was like and what Whitehall Palace, Tudor Hall, was like, since it burnt down in the 18th century. This is just purely emblematic material I'm showing you, just an example. We actually had, fortunately, quite a rich array of materials relating to this production of Florimine, including all of the stage designs, most of the stage designs, the floor, ground plans, elevations, and the lot. And so from that, we had more of a better evidence than one usually has in going about recreating the actual stage settings. Now this is kind of fundamental introduction to 3D modeling using modeling packages. You create very crude, unadorned, unrendered images, first of all, so that you can get your shapes and your sight lines and fit your images and your model into the parameters that your evidence dictates for you. And then after you do that, you begin adding on the colored renderings. And again, the designs were not in color, that's to say the surviving designs from Indigo Jones, but there were indications of what the colors were. So that meant, depending on how far you wanted to take the research, looking into the kind of palette, the kind of colors that Jones and his assistants used. It's very intriguing. In some cases, these models, these designs themselves, the original papers of Jones, actually are splattered with scenic paint. So they give you a kind of immediacy there, like the sand falling out onto your lap from the ancient manuscript that somebody mentioned yesterday. You have that immediacy of the grease paint and the color. Moving right on through, you can see this is a three-dimensional stage section. It's a virtual design in that sense, in the sense that Jones himself created, using two-dimensional flats, the illusion of a three-dimensional space. Old hat now, but absolutely revolutionary in its day and time. Really the first perspective stage settings, as I said before, in the mass, and now in the first production of a play done in this country using that. The model which Jones created had to be incorporated into a hall which was not actually built as a stage. So that meant he had to take the hall and adapt his design so that it fit reasonably comfortably within it. And of course we had to do the same thing in modeling the hall and then placing his designs back within it. The Whitehall masks were extraordinarily important state occasions. They figured in diplomatic reports, for example, indicating where a person was seated, because that indicated what his or her status was in court, who was in, who was out. Not surprisingly, the King, James, or later Charles, had the best seat in the House right here in the so-called state, because that's where all the perspective worked just right. It's a little bit like having a modern laptop where you have to position yourself in order to get the image quite right. The same kind of analogy was working there. And of course, when you move to either side, the sight lines became pretty lousy, and you began to see around the edges quite literally of what you were looking at. We also undertook more recently some lighting experiments with this space. Nobody knows quite.
Turn the lights off, Richard, because I'm getting a wonderful ghost.
Yeah, and well, somebody can put the lights off. That'd be great. I'm fine here. Thanks. It is murky. It has to be said. The lighting, we don't really know how it was lit. We don't have very detailed accounts. So we're engaging now in various experiments using the kinds of lighting apparatus which may have been involved. Jones himself refers to using reflectors at various places, and the contemporaneous feedback reviews spoke of dazzling, brilliant lighting. Now, of course, just how dazzling and brilliant can be made using simple candlelight suggests to us the element of relativity that's involved here. What seemed dazzling because it was unprecedented to a contemporary audience, contemporaneous audience would probably see rather murky and dim to us. Now, just a few more of these to indicate the possibilities. And obviously, we will hang more lights to get more lighting. But for now, this is just an initial run to see what these canvases may have looked like under this kind of ambient lighting. And of course, one of the advantages of it was that under the full glare of modern electric lighting, one sees the bends and the joints. But under this kind of lighting, it probably does indeed tend to fade in and become more realistic. And finally, I'm going to show you just an animation. Hopefully. This is one of those inevitable spinning fly-throughs that we referred to the other day, but it is how we show off the final results of what we have created. Now, our own address to the challenge of visualization, and in particular, the communication of its meanings and how such visual and virtual things can assist us in thinking, takes the form not of the scathing satirical poem diatribe Ben Jonson wrote, but a more moderate, if less poetical, document called the London Charter. What I showed you here a moment ago was a fairly simple and straightforward modeling task. We had good evidence. It was not hugely problematic, and I showed it to you as an example of a kind of semi-complex task. At the end of my talk at this time, I'm going to refer to you a much more complex task, the so-called Pompey Project, where you'll see in greater detail the ranges of choices, the ranges of raw ingredients that go into the modeling process, which have to somehow be taken into account and made transparent for the evaluation of the outcomes. The London Charter Initiative, and there were copies out, and there may be copies still, you're certainly welcome to take away, because we will be asking for feedback. The initiative seeks to establish what's required for 3D visualization to be seen and to be seen to be as intellectually rigorous and robust as other research models. The initiative has to be seen in the context of what has become really a quite burning issue in 3D visualization, which is the issue of transparency. Transparency is crucial if this new technology is to mature as a research method, as obviously we hope it will, and acquire widespread acceptance within the subject communities which it caters to. In particular, it has to be possible for those communities to evaluate the choices, the kinds of choices I referred to a moment ago, of a given visualization method, to see how it was applied in a particular case without having to rely exclusively on the authority claims of the author. Here it is, take it or leave it. I say it's good. Very significant work has already been done in the area, and there's now quite an extensive bibliography on this related issues. Previous initiatives, briefly to date, have included the CAA Virtual Archaeology Special Interest Group, VASI, which first met in Sweden in 2001, the Cultural Virtual Reality Organization, CVRO, which was launched at the VAST conference in November of 2000, but is now inactive, the AHDS Guide for Creating and Using Virtual Reality, edited by Kate Fernie and our own Julian Richards in 2002, and also relevant is the AHDS CAD Guide, edited by Harrison Eideljord and others, which was also in 2002. So the issue has been around for some time. Last July, in 2005, King's Visualization Lab, which I lead, commenced a project funded by the AHRC called Making Space. It was to investigate a methodology for tracking and documenting the cognitive process in three-dimensional visualization-based research. My colleague Drew Baker proposed the term paradata as part of the application process. He used the term to denote the intellectual capital that's generated in the process of a research project like this. And he highlighted that a great deal of this intellectual capital, this information which is essential to understanding and evaluating the 3D method and its outcomes, is currently being lost. It's the stuff which, you know, when people are leaning over one another's shoulders and saying, no, I think it should be that way, and what's your evidence for that? Well, my evidence is Vitruvius says so. Those kinds of discussions, the decisions, the choices, and the outcomes, that's part of the research process, but it's largely invisible in what's finally rendered up on your screen at the end of the day. It's take it or leave it, a syndrome. So in order to have this as a research process taken as seriously as we would like it to, we've got to find some way of documenting that process, and we've come up with the term paradata simply as a tag to describe what it is, those kinds of discussions which are essential but somewhat invisible. The project subsequently convened a symposium and an expert seminar at the British Academy and the CCH last February. It was jointly sponsored by the ICT Methods Network and by the EPOC Network of Excellence that Dave leads. Over a two-day symposium, about 50 of us debated approaches to the issue of transparency. And on the third day, a smaller group of experts stayed behind to discuss the first discussion document phase of a draft London Charter. More recently, my colleague at King's Hugh Dinard and I presented the draft charter, at EPOC EVA conference several weeks ago in Florence, and we've begun to circulate it to as many interested parties, including those of us here now, as possible. The nature of the charter is that it's indebted, obviously, to previous work in the area, not least the recommendations of the CAD Guide. But it's not meant to be discipline-specific. It's not just for archaeologists, and only for them, but rather for the whole range of arts, humanities, cultural heritage disciplines who are currently using 3D visualization or might wish to take it up and use it in the future. It follows the format and style of the Commons Inami Charter, which is to provide a ready-to-hand language, but also to facilitate the ease of recognition within cultural heritage contexts that already exist. The Inami Charter addresses the use of cultural definition, use, maintenance of cultural heritage objects, and we're picking up on some of that language because it's clearly cognate related to what we're dealing with. The charter adopts a wide definition of the term cultural heritage, encompassing all domains of human activity which are concerned with the understanding of communication of material and intellectual culture. Such domains include, I'm quoting the charter now, include but are not limited to museums, art galleries, heritage sites, interpretive centers, cultural heritage research institutes, arts and humanities subjects within higher education, and the broader educational sector, as well as, of course, tourism. The aims. We hope that it's going to acquire a sufficient standing, sufficient acceptability within that relevant and far-sprung community to be adopted as an EU and international benchmark. We recognise that a document that aspires to be a charter should address more than just a single issue of transparency. There are other issues which have been identified, and that there are more fundamental imperatives underlying than just the simple presentation problem of transparency. We need to tackle these issues at a principle level as opposed to a pragmatic level. That's to say, we're laying out broad principles which will have applicability rather than giving a piece-by-piece pragmatic solution which would be very quickly out of date. The subject communities, as the symposium proceeded, it became pretty clear that while we wanted to create a charter which would be valid across all domains in which 3D visualization can be applied to cultural heritage, nevertheless, different subject areas had different approaches and differed quite substantially in their understandings of what that research might be, and therefore what research methods would be amenable to being investigated through 3D visualization. This imposes strict limits upon the level of detail that a cross-subject document such as this can actually entertain. So, consequently, the draft commends that while subject areas should adopt and build upon the principles established by the Charter, they should also develop more detailed principles, standards, recommendations, and guidelines to assure that the use of 3D visualization coheres with the aims and the objectives and the methods of their own particular domain. We recognize the need to ensure cohesion between aims and methods, and the draft recognizes that 3D visualization methods and outcomes can be used to address quite a wide range of research and communication aims. It's not one size fits all, but it's clearly a very broad spectrum of uses. But we also wanted to establish that it's only one method among many, that it shouldn't be assumed that 3D visualization is always the most appropriate method for addressing all research or communication aims. It shouldn't seem to become fashionable or imperative that you use this in contexts where the same aim, the same task can be communicated more effectively using cheaper and more straightforward means. And clearly, 3D visualization, one of the principles we lay down is that it should normally be used when other methods would not be as appropriate or as effective. We address the nature and integrity of resources, or sources. This arose in particular out of a presentation by Daniel Plitnik in which he gave a demonstration to the group highlighting how important the task of carefully assessing the sources that we use before we start using them, and of paying attention to the kinds of aesthetic and ideological factors, something which David just referred to in his talk, that condition our visual sources in particular. The draft proposes a definition of sources as all information, digital and non-digital, considered during or directly influencing the creation of 3D visualization outcomes. I identified just a handful of them in the chloramine visualization a moment ago. In a few minutes when I talk about the Pompey project, you'll see a much larger, much wider spectrum of these sources. The Charter recommends that in order to ensure the intellectual integrity of 3D visualization methods and outcomes, relevant sources need to be identified and evaluated in a structured way. These then were the first three guiding principles before we got to principle number four, which is transparency requirements as such. Here the draft recommends that sufficient information should be provided to allow 3D visualization methods and outcomes to be understood and evaluated appropriately in relation to the context in which they're being used and disseminated. Let's look at the transparency requirements section in a little more detail. It proposes that it should be made clear what kind and status of information the 3D visualization, the kind of end product, if you will, the research outcome as such, what it actually represents, the nature and degree of factual uncertainty that's still contained within it, as a hypothetical reconstruction, for instance, which needs to be communicated. You can't simply say this is it, but rather an indication of this is it according to this hypothesis, which is informed by this data and this kind of decision-making and evaluation. It also recognizes that the type and quantity of transparency information will of necessity vary depending on the aims and the type of visualization method that's being deployed, as well as the type and level of knowledge, understanding, and expectations of its anticipated end users. You don't need to overload something which might be used at a heritage site or a museum with the kinds of information which you'll be presenting to a group of archaeologists or theater historians, for example. Transparency information requirements may therefore differ from project to project, or even within different phases of a particular project. The transparency requirements of 3D visualization projects may differ from those of other projects because of the high occurrence of dependency relationships within 3D models. I'll say more about that in a moment, but essentially it means that if the process and its outcomes are going to be evaluated by those outside the project, it may be necessary to disseminate with the project the documentation of the interpretive decisions made in the course of the visualization process. A dependency relationship is simply a relationship, a dependent relationship between the properties and elements within a 3D model in such a way that a change in one of those will inevitably have a knock-on effect upon some or even perhaps in some cases all of the other elements of the model. And it will necessitate a change in the dependent properties. For example, if you change the height of a door, it's going to necessitate a corresponding change in the height of the door frame. And we encounter those kinds of questions very frequently. Indeed, from time to time, they allow us to interrogate the validity of our evidence because in modeling, we will come up against incompatible elements like that, where clearly there is an error somewhere in the data that we're using, and those have to be resolved. Or if you don't resolve them, you leave it in the model and say, as a model, which I'll show you a little bit later, here it is, the evidence is not reconcilable, but this is what it would look like if you built it as it asks you to build it, as it were, architectural warts and all. Documentation. The process and outcomes of 3D visualization creation should be sufficiently documented to enable the creation of accurate transparency records, potential reuse of the research conducted, and its outcomes in new contexts, enhanced resource discovery and accessibility, and to promote understanding beyond the original subject community. Now, these are all notional, to some extent, subjective decisions, and they'll be dependent upon each project. But we wanted to lay down the principle that this kind of documentation is essential if these projects are going to be taken, or wish to be claimed to be taken, seriously. The sixth section of the charter is on standards, and this is, at this point, the least developed section of the draft. It was felt that it being a cross-subject and long-term document, it wasn't really the place of the charter to espouse a particular standard, such as CIDOC, CRM. It was also recognized that we were only going to be able to begin to develop appropriate ontologies and choose appropriate standards as we improve our understanding of what it is we're doing, how we tend to use the 3D visualizations and their methods and outcomes, and that's going to require further research and contemplation. Consequently, the first draft proposes that appropriate standards and ontologies should be identified at subject community level, systematically to develop 3D visualization methods and outcomes to be documented to enable optimum inter and intra-subject and domain interoperability and comparability. In other words, these things will be refined and detailed at subject level, following, we hope, these overarching principles. The question of sustainability, of course, arose. The draft notes that 3D visualization outcomes pertaining to cultural heritage themselves constitute a growing part of our intellectual, social, economic, and cultural heritage, and that if this heritage is not to be squandered, we have to develop appropriate strategies to ensure its long-term sustainability. Again, something that David touched upon. We need to plan and implement these strategies for sustainability. It also points out that, somewhat in desperation, I suppose, that a partial two-dimensional record of a 3D visualization output should be referred to the absence of any record at all. So if you find that your animations no longer work, at least a few evocative images of what you came out with, still images, would be better than simply losing that work altogether. The specific recommendations contained in the draft are really just a first pass. Expected to be debated further. For example, from the floor of the symposium that we held at London, David Roby suggested, or pointed out to us, reminded us really, it became clear that we have to continue to make the case for this technologically expensive work in the arts and humanities. We need to explain its value and its value for money, and also to consider that work in cultural heritage, broadly defined, is for the most part publicly funded, and that many 3D visualization outputs have a high potential degree of repurposability. It's incumbent upon us, he felt, the author agreed, incumbent upon us to consider whether our work might have a value beyond our immediate uses of it. Hence, the draft Principle 8 states that consideration should be given to the ways in which the outcomes of 3D visualization work could contribute to the wider study, understanding, interpretation, and management of cultural heritage assets, a kind of recycling or reprocessing, multi-use employment stuff that we create. 3D visualization clearly has important roles to play in enhancing access to cultural heritage that's not otherwise accessible for health and safety, disability, economic, political, or environmental reasons, or because the object of the visualization is itself lost, or endangered, dispersed, or has been restored or reconstructed. There's also clearly a soft political dimension, as well as an idealistic one to this, to the draft sections that seek to establish that 3D visualization permits types and degrees of access not otherwise possible, including the study of change over time, magnification, modification, virtual object manipulation. Again, David gave us a great example of that. Multi-layered embedded data and information, instantaneous global distribution with consequent expanded curatorial possibilities. But there may also, of course, be economic benefits to both the research, education, tourism, interpretation sectors from the increased communication and collaboration which this will bring about amongst themselves. And these are good reasons as well to include them in the charter. We have a section on guide documents. The charter is designed, as I've said, to establish some fundamental principles, which are sufficiently focused so that they can have an impact, but sufficiently abstract that its principles remain current, or will remain current, as methods and technologies evolve. Therefore, more specific recommendations about technology, standards, methodologies, while they're needed, really we felt, the group felt, belong to a different kind of document, and in particular, subject-specific guides. The importance of subject perspective is enshrined as a principle in the charter, quoting, specialist subject communities will need to develop more detailed principles, standards, recommendations, and guidelines to ensure that use of 3D visualization coheres with the aims, objectives, and methods of their own domain. Guides might help, for example, to develop consensus around visual conventions and technical approaches for different methods. A number of case study processes has already begun. At the expert seminar, it was proposed to conduct a number of these to see how what we call paradata could, should be recorded in specific pilot projects. And it's been suggested that in order to help us to do this, it would also be useful to observe as systematically as possible how we reflect upon, choose, communicate traditional research methods. This would then help us develop a profile of what might be lacking, what kinds of methodological and processual information is considered necessary to document these other research methods, and then to base our own recommendations on, to some degree, on comparability with established academic standards. In addition to benefiting from their example, it could also enable us to make some persuasive arguments to traditional scholars about the validity of 3D visualization methods in terms that they can readily understand and, in a sense, buy into. A number of case studies have already been initiated. There's one by Graham Earle at the University of Southampton, Donald Saunders, the president of the Institute for Visualization History of America, KVL at London, my group are undertaking one, and Soren Herman at the VAS Lab in Florence as well, and I should say we would welcome others. It's envisaged that as the charter is revised in response to consultation within the various subject communities for which it has some relevance, it'll both stimulate debate on key issues in its various versions, will come to act as a de facto standard, at least. Because 3D visualization refers to a widely used method relevant to a domain, there's at present no single organization corresponding to e-commas that can coordinate structured consultation and redrafting. And so we're actually going to be centering this at King's. Anna, who will be speaking a little bit later, and Julie Tomey, who are research fellows, will be acting as a kind of secretariat, whereby the under the direction of Hugh Dinard, whereby suggestions, amendments, discussion documents will come in and be disseminated to anyone who's interested. It'll be a kind of a clearinghouse, because it's important to emphasize, as I did on the first day, that this is only a first draft and is by no means meant to be fundamental or final or authoritative, but already we're receiving suggestions and undertaking further and as discussion as widely as possible. A web spot site will be established with the current draft, a history of the initiative and an explanation of the process, and a list of future consultation events. We really welcome other recommendations. But I want to conclude with just a few more pretty pictures by way of, I hope, suggesting the kinds of complexities that might be involved. I'm going to begin by just putting up a document which I emphatically do not expect you to read, but it's an example, it's an example of the kind of complexity, the kind of paradata that goes into, in this case, in this case, designing the Scandi Frans, the stage facade of the Theatre of Pompey. In order to produce the pretty picture, which you'll see in a couple moments, fairly elaborate weighing of evidence, process of argument, the use of comparanda from other sites, such as in this case the Theatre of Marcellus, and elsewhere, had to be used so that the evidence that we did collect could actually, I'm going to just jump ahead, could actually be used plausibly for our model. We didn't want, we were incapable of simply creating a pretty picture. We had to create an image which was based upon a just evaluation of as much evidence as possible. We prepared, as part of this process, because the Theatre of Pompey no longer exists, as anything other than a dispersed fragment built into and upon by later buildings, we created an archaeological register where we went back over the centuries and recorded the details forensically of every bit of information that had been that could come to us about the theater. A shaft would be dug up in 1860, and if it was described in the Notizie della Scavi, we would take down all of that information, gradually build up a database so that when we began to reconstruct our theater facade, we could argue from that evidence plausibly to indicate what the composition of the first order of columns, for example, its height, its dimensions, the second order, the third order, and so on. And again, just going down very quickly, some of the data that we used and the results, so that the image I'm going to show you in a few minutes is based upon this process of consideration. Now, you don't see any of that when you look at the model, but it's paradigm. And in order for you or anybody else to take the model seriously, you need to have access to it. And at the moment, of course, that's very difficult, or at least we haven't discovered the best, most efficient way of linking this data immediately to users of the model, to the model itself, for users. Well, with that indication of the complexity of the data that we kind of data that we draw upon, I'm going to show you, I hope, an animation of the Pompey project. It's a pretty picture, but it goes on for about 3 minutes, I suppose. And you will see there, I ask you, invite you to consider it, looking at the number of data types, the type of artifacts, the type of evidence, kinds of decisions that had to be made in order to come up with the final model. Theatre of Pompey, as I imagine most of you know, was the first permanent theatre built in Rome in 55 BC. Caesar was assassinated in a section of it, the Curia, in 44. It remained in use for almost six centuries. The last reference to its use is 509 AD, so it had a very long innings. And a great deal of it still exists, but surprisingly, until we undertook this project funded by the then AHRB and the Beaverfield Trust, there had never been a modern scientific investigation of it. Never been properly measured, nobody had gone in and photographed it or drawn it in detail. The last intervention was in 1835 by Vital Valtard, and his designs, his conclusions were endlessly recycled up to the present day. So we undertook to investigate this theater, to view every remaining bit of it that was visible or accessible in any ways, which literally meant knocking on doors and saying, what do you have in the way of ruins? And then going down and gaining access, hopefully photographing, drawing, designing, and ultimately modeling them. And then that led ultimately to a request to undertake an excavation, first in 150 years, which was granted, and it's now an ongoing excavation in Rome to answer some particular questions, which we only really knew how to ask, or at least we only knew where to ask them, what section of the remaining existing state to ask those questions of once we had done this analysis. So in that sense, the visualization process certainly proved its worth. This is the Campo dei Fiori, looking at the backside of the theater, where the Temple of Venus, which crowned it, was located. This is the general area, and you see the curve on the left. That's the curve of the ancient auditorium, as the later buildings were built on top of it. And you can see the footprint of the whole complex here. The gray area is the theater and its porticus post Scaenum, and the Curia, the Senate House at one end. So it's clearly left its mark on the city. And upon the imagination, various people, this is the work of Canina in 1835, various people, scholars, have tried to envisage what this theater might have been like using such evidence as was at hand, primarily the so-called marble plan, the Forma Urbis, which was a to-scale ancient map of the city, which preserves certain depictions, fragmentary depictions of the theater. Again, these are Canina's drawings, and one of the projects which we gave ourselves was to model his two-dimensional versions, his plans and elevations. Here we've modeled Canina, not to say this is right, but to say this is what Canina thought it would look like. Because we wanted to interrogate previous interpretations of the theater as well as develop our own interpretation. That's the overall complex. Give you an idea of the scale. The stage there is 300 feet wide. I did not misspeak by saying it's a football pitch. 300 feet wide. This again is not our model, although we created it. This is the model of Canina's visualization of the theater according to his plans and drawings. He famously had a central staircase because Pompey claimed he wasn't actually building a theater, he was building a temple of Venus with a few steps leading up to it, and thus got around the strictures of the Senate forbidding the construction of a permanent theater. It was a fairly specious argument, but he was a very powerful man at the time. Again, these marble compositions are based upon his suggestion, not upon our own hypothesis. This is our hypothesis of what the theater was looked like, and you saw from the document I showed you before that we have a plausible basis for arguing about much of that evidence. And then finally, the inevitable turning document, turning model, but to show you the relationship between the theater and the existing state of the buildings that have encrusted upon it. We modeled the existing state. To give you some idea of the size of the theater, the foundations extend some 6 meters below the existing street level and about 3 meters above the highest point of this building. So you have to imagine an absolutely enormous structure there. And again, building on that photographic footprint that I showed you before, you can see the relationship between that existing state and that once and future state of the theater. We then did get permission to do an excavation, and we chose there because we believed it to put us in this ambulocrum, the circular annular corridor, and at the base of the Temple of Venus. And those excavations are ongoing. And we have confirmed, without giving too much away, we have confirmed the foundations of the Temple of Venus, where we've done, there's an article in the current issue of the American Journal of Archaeology by James Packer. This is the last day of last summer's excavation, where we actually got down to ground level, finally, in the theater. That's all I have to say. Thank you very much.